We've also invited Channing Arendt. He's the Environment and Production Technology Division Head or Director for the International Food Policy Research Institute. I know Channing from before because he worked in South Africa on the carbon tax, has done a lot of work on the African continent, actually on the climate and development nexus, and he's also looked at things like food security and so on. And he's well-versed not only to speak about these issues in a broad way, but to also give insights from his research on the African continent. Channing is actually participating from the US. It just shows his dedication. It's, I think, like 3:30 a.m. in the morning there. And he's really taken the time and effort to be here, and we want to thank him tremendously for that. Thank you, Channing. Over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Salim. And I'm really happy to be here. It's a little bit early, but it's actually easier than flying all the way out to Cape Town. So this is quite nice. I'm going to go and look internationally at what's been happening, and then bring it into Africa. So here is just, you know, one thing that's happened is a coal use in the United States, and this runs to about 2008-2009, when the Copenhagen COP took place, and you could see coal use in the U.S. just going up, regularly, quite stable for a while, and then we have this Copenhagen COP, which famously failed. And all the expectations were that coal use would continue to increase, sort of the trend lines that are showing there. And what actually happened in the U.S. is that the coal use went and has dropped off dramatically. And there's a whole series of reasons for that. But one of them is the renewables, and right now we're looking at, for the most recent data point for February 2020, is the lowest coal use in the United States in more than 50 years. It's the lowest data point in the series that I can get, and coal use is trending down. So things can and do change, and there's, like I said, a lot of factors behind the drop in coal consumption in the U.S. But one of them is the renewables. So this is the look at in the global sector power generation, and we've seen increases. So in the past 5 years, investment in energy generation has been about $250 billion. Greater than $250 billion each year for the past 5 years. And every year that is buying more power because the price of renewables is dropping. So last year, the last year for which we have data, I think it's 2018, more than two-thirds of total new installed net generation was wind, or mainly wind and solar. So there's been a huge move in solar generation globally. Now, a lot of this happening in China and in the developed world, and it's starting to happen in Africa as well. So if we look, and this is one of my favorite graphs, and one of the reasons that we can be quite optimistic about solar power in Africa is just the level of resource. There's just a lot of sun on the African continent, and we can see it here. So this is a picture for South Africa, and its comparison with Germany. And according to this data set, the very worst place in South Africa the worst possible site for solar generation in South Africa is better than the best possible site for solar generation in Germany. I mean, yes. So, the difference in resource is enormous. We spoke about, Carlos and others spoke about our oil reserves, or the oil reserves in Africa. But there's also a solar endowment that is really remarkable and far, far better than, for example, what you would find in Germany. And this is one of the reasons why when we're working on the electricity system for South Africa, These days, we really think that renewables, a combination of wind and solar, is the cheapest possible source for generation for South Africa, and by extension for much of the continent at all use levels. And this is happening both because of the solar resource. In South Africa, we also have excellent wind resources. And that one of the big advantages, so the red on the left-hand side for South Africa is the high-quality wind resources. And one of the big advantages of South African wind resources is that they're distributed around the country, and South Africa has a pretty good electricity distribution grid. And so the distribution of the wind resources means, because it's likely to be windy somewhere, the average power output, if you distribute your wind turbines around the country, is relatively stable, and you get to a sort of a portfolio effect of generation. And this is one of the factors that makes renewable energy such an attractive option for South Africa over the coming years. So if we look and continue that point, some opportunities, and I think we've already mentioned regional issues and regional trade. And if we extend out and look beyond South Africa, if you can distribute your generation assets, your wind and your solar across space, so across more space into Namibia, Angola, Zambia, and so forth, then you're going to get an even broader generation effect, and it's likely to be windy and or sunny somewhere, and so you get a more stable power output. The other big opportunity in Southern Africa, for sure, and also on the Nile and elsewhere, is to use existing hydropower or new hydropower to load balance. Typically, with hydropower, you just run the turbines all the time, but you don't have to do it that way. In many places now, in order to load balance, so if you turn turbines off when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, so you have a lot of renewable energy assets that are generating a lot of electricity and you don't need the electricity, and water basically piles up behind the dam, and you turn them on when the wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining and you need the electricity. You have to respect environmental flow constraints. But again, if you have a large grid, then you can turn turbines on and off on different dams and keep the impacts on flow to a minimum. So these are some real opportunities that exist, I think, in the region, on the Zambezi and in the Nile, to generate the electricity that would drive some of the at low prices that would drive some of the industrialization that Carlos was talking about. As both were saying, we have to do this in a context of climate change, and this is happening now. So this is a look at we have this for the whole African continent. This is just a look at temperature in Mozambique. And it's just this decade, the 2020s, and climate relative to 1990. So this is called a box and whisker plot. And so we've got on the horizontal axis, we've got temperature. And inside the box, the upper, the red box that's above, is about 50% of temperature outcomes. And in the whiskers, within the whiskers is the range of the distribution. So typically won't go below the left-hand whisker, and it won't go above the right-hand whisker. And the dots are outliers. The blue line at the top just signifies that the climate was what it was in 1990. There isn't a variation on that. In the 2020s, we don't know what climate is going to look like exactly. There could be just a little bit of warming, the blue on the left-hand side, or there could be quite a bit more warming, and about 50% of outcomes are within the blue box. And so that's the range that we're looking at with just climate. one of the new things that we've done is put weather on top of the climate change. So when you add just the fact that weather is variable, you don't know what it's going to be like, what the weather is going to be like on any given day, and it could be hot or it could be cool. You add quite significantly to the range of temperature with a lot of really high temperature outcomes. So this really drives evaporation, and it puts a lot of emphasis on the water resources. Similarly, we're looking at a lot of uncertainty in what's going to happen to precipitation. So this is exactly the same type of graph, box and whisker plot for precipitation in the 2020s, and this is in the main growing season, 3 months of the main growing season in Mozambique. And what we're looking at is both the possibilities of, when you add climate and weather, of having either much lower precipitation than we would expect within the range is getting bigger, or greater precipitation. And so this is both from the perspective of drought and from the perspective of flood, but it really puts the highlight on the water resources and conserving water resources, and it goes back to using your hydropower resources as well as possible, so that you can practice the agriculture in a climate smart way, deploy irrigation and other methods that's going to help to combat the climate crisis. So those are the things that I wanted to bring up in this initial part, and I'm happy to move on to discussion. So back to you, Salim.
Thank you, Channing. That was really fascinating, and thanks for illustrating the huge potential on the African continent for building renewables infrastructure and the manner in which it could be developed. So maybe if I can just reflect on some of the questions that have been put forward. How do you facilitate a just transition where, in many cases where there's been coal and fossil economies, workers have lost their jobs or are in danger of losing their jobs? Can renewables actually create new job opportunities? How do you make that happen? Again, Channing, you may want to respond to this. And I have two other questions that I thought you may want to answer. And if you're okay, if I can just relay them to you. So the one question is actually from former Minister Rob Davies. I think you know him well. What might be a reimagined infrastructure development program that build health resilience against extreme weather events and addresses vulnerabilities linked to squalid living conditions look like? So what is this reimagined infrastructure? I know it's a challenging question, but I thought you might have some thoughts. And there's a question around one of your slides, a clarification. And this is with regard to renewables in the US. Could you please speak to the issue of renewables on the first graph showing the drop off of coal in the US? It seemed the renewables was tailing off too. Is this correct? And maybe just to respond to those two and any other questions that you feel you can address. So over to you, Channing.
Okay, thanks very much. I'll take the renewables one first. The drivers of the decline in coal was initially natural gas, but that's come behind. Now there's a substantial increase in wind power and in solar power, and that's been a big part of the driver since that time. So those are the main drivers. We're seeing increases in renewable use, despite the fact that the Trump administration is pushing coal. So even though they're pushing coal, we now have the lowest coal use in the U.S. in since the data series began. I'm going to leave Rob Davies' question for the end. So maybe I'll think about it as I'm talking. I think that Carlos did a great job of talking about what you might call the macroeconomic space issue. It's a problem, obviously, just a lot more constrained. The Treasury just can't issue bonds at negative interest rates That's not going to happen. So you confront these difficulties, and he mentioned these higher interest rates that are paid in developing countries, and this has a big deal for climate finance because most of these climate investments, most of the cost of wind power, solar power, hydropower even, are right up front at the beginning. So the interest costs are really material. So the climate finance issue is something, I spoke about this advantage in terms of endowments, and I think that's really important. But at the same time, you have to come to grips with the finance issue. One of the issues that I think is really interesting that we haven't delved into quite enough is if you think about traditional, for example, a coal-fired power plant will take 7 to 10 years to build. And so you're obliged to be sitting there saying, okay, how much electricity are we going to need in 7 to 10 years? And then you start building the coal-fired power plant today. Well, who knows how much electricity demand South Africa or any African country is going to need in 7 to 10 years. This is really quite an issue. This is one of the reasons why the continent as a whole started to brown out in about 2008, 9, 10, because nobody back in 2000 really thought that the continent was going to grow at the rate that it actually did in the first decade of the 2000s. Renewables are different. Once you have a solar farm or a wind farm, you can relatively easily, they're quite modular. Within 6 months, you can add. So there is the issue with renewables of trying to match supply and demand, at a moment in time and instantaneously. But in terms of being able to match supply with demand over, as growth trajectories of the economy are going, there's a big advantage there. And that should come back to the consideration of how this could be financed and the sovereign debt sorts of issues that come up. Carlos is absolutely correct in terms of COVID-19, the policies that are coming into place. As you well know, it's a big deal. And there are a lot of short-term imperatives. There's no doubt that globally in Africa and Asia and elsewhere, food security is being threatened. And largely, initially, it's just a consequence of reduced buying power, reduced earnings, and an inability to actually buy food. In South Africa, we've done some analysis, and government transfers are helping quite a bit. So that's an important point, but it goes back to the macro space point that Carlos brought up at the beginning. You have to keep that expenditure going, and you've got many other expenditure needs that you want to take care of, and you're going to have to find the funding for that. It's just not an easy time at this point. In terms of renewables and jobs, I agree completely with Tasneem. The economy-wide approach is absolutely what you need to do. Certainly in places where you have a number of coal mines, you're not automatically going to get the jobs that you want. I think there's been some really good work at UCT looking at, because you basically a particular coal mine will feed a particular power plant, so you're going to know, since you have a schedule for decommissioning of the coal-fired plants, you're going to know which coal mine is affected, the age profile of workers and so forth, so you can do a fair amount of work to get to what's happening there, and that's been done. It's I think when you take it on the economy-wide perspective, the renewables are slightly more labor intensive, so as you shift, you can generate some jobs, but you also get big effects if you have cheaper electricity. Then you get the kind of industrialization, the shift towards manufacturers that Carlos was talking about, and you create jobs. The other factor is right now, if renewables are cheaper, then you don't need to allocate as much of this precious capital that Carlos was talking about to electricity generation. You can allocate capital to factories, other productive assets, or the infrastructure that Rob Davies was talking about. I want to point out, and I think this is important, that we're looking at a just transition now, and just transition away from coal, and that's very, very important. It's what is there on the menu right at the moment. looking forward, if you're going to contain climate change, you're going to need a transition in transport as well. Electrification of transport is coming. And that is going to be a much, much bigger transition than shifting from coal-fired generation of power to renewable generation. You know, if you look in South Africa, it's going to affect the motor industry development program. It'll affect all retail sale of fuel. It affects the whole distribution of fuel. It's going to affect every repair shop. Maintenance of the internal combustion engine won't be necessary if it's electrical. Electric engines are incredibly reliable and don't really require very much maintenance at all. So that's going to affect a lot more jobs. And I think, having your eyes open to that transition is going to be important. And it's also, I think, one of the reasons that you have this price war between Saudi Arabia, Russia, and others is there's a realization that we're just not going to burn all of the oil that we have, especially if this is going to electrify. So places that can produce cheaply, like Saudi Arabia, are willing to put the prices low to force other producers out. And Africa is not a low cost producer. So Nigeria and Angola and others who are exporters are going to be feeling this pinch for quite some time. South Africa as an importer will benefit from the oil. Reimagined infrastructure. And I think in particular, you need to think about the extreme events. High heat will do things to, for example, the rail network. In South Africa, you don't have to worry as much about the cyclones, but certainly you do in Mozambique. And a lot of it really revolves around water. Building roads such that you're not on a 50-year floodplain that might turn into a 10-year floodplain, for example. In South Africa, the work that we did for the long-term adaptation strategies really emphasized the existing water infrastructure that South Africa has. And the ability to move water between basins is incredibly important for an uncertain climate future. And that's both in terms of being able to irrigate in agriculture, but also making sure that municipal and industrial use isn't disrupted. The only place that really doesn't have that capability is where it's gotten the driest is down around Cape Town. You can't really, it's too far to get across, but up in around Johannesburg and in the northern and eastern sections, there's good ability to move water between basins, and keeping that infrastructure in place is quite important. I think you can also, we're talking about a reimagined infrastructure in the form of the energy infrastructure. And I think that's very much in process. I mean, it's in people's heads. And I think that looking forward, we want to take a regional perspective to that infrastructure. I think that will bring, it's a more robust system. And it brings back the region, the Southern Africa region, as potentially a very, very low cost electricity with a series of advantages for jobs and other social developments. So I'll leave it there for that. Thanks. Back to Salim.
Channing, if I can ask you maybe 3 minutes or so, if you can make your final remarks, and then I'll try to round off.
Yep. Sure. Thanks a lot. I'll just make a couple of points. I think on the international institutional architecture, I think it was clear, even 2 years ago, or it's been clear for a while, that really we have an international institutional architecture that's a 20th century institutional architecture with a lot of 20th century institutions, and these are trapped in the 21st century. And there was always a lot of need for reform, governance of those institutions, the way it functions, the problems that it addresses, and so forth. And now with the COVID crisis, I think you've exposed that even more. I think it was Carlos that brought up the point about trade in protective equipment as well as reagents, and how that was disrupted quite quickly. And obviously that's going to come and factor into people's decision to trade in other things like food, for example. That's also quite critical. And you know, what kind of security do you have if you're going to rely on international markets that can become, you know, very fickle the moment a crisis comes into existence. And that's something that also the international community will have to deal with. The second area is just in renewable energy infrastructure. And I think, you know, you have two phrases in English: one, bigger is better, and small is beautiful. And with renewable energy, it's both. I've emphasized a little bit the big grids, the regional trade, and I think you do need that for lighting Johannesburg and Durban and Lusaka and the industrial sectors and so forth. At the same time, Tasnim has emphasized mini grids and community-based energy generation, and that also is a tremendous opportunity for particularly places that are a long way from grids or have other reasons that they want to generate their own power, and there's a ton of opportunity there. So I think that's very important, and both of those apply. Renewable energy brings both of those opportunities.